Hi everyone, welcome back to Race to the Top. In today's episode, we'll be talking to Tolu Ferrinto about things like ironing shirts, playing the keyboards in the church band, conversations being its own reward, and the fact that he's stubbornly manual. At the end of this conversation, I felt completely enlightened. I hope you will do too. Let's get into it. You are a busy man, my friend. Welcome onto the podcast.
Thank you. It's an absolute pleasure. Some people would say I'm too busy.
Yeah.
And when I say some people, I'd say my mum.
Yeah.
She reminds me often.
Yeah. Do you feel too busy?
It ebbs and it flows. It ebbs and it flows. But everything I love, so it never feels like work, to use the cliche.
Yeah, yeah. What's the most... Where'd you get your energy from?
I probably get my energy from Limitless.
Right.
I love music. I could spend every waking moment listening to it. And the fact that I get to open that experience up for so many young kids who've never experienced a live music show before and probably won't because of the different challenges that they're facing from an economic perspective, it just gives me infinite amounts of energy. Some at the same time.
Yeah, we can get into it, but it's really important that music can be in some way free, right? You know, when you end up going to Taylor Swift like I did and it's hundreds and hundreds of pounds, you know, that's dropping loads and loads of people from different demographics, socio-demographic backgrounds out of music, and that can't really be allowed to happen, can it?
1,000%. You are one of the lucky few who managed to get their hands on a Taylor ticket, but some people are selling cars, houses, kidneys even, cheek, but just to get their hands on some tickets. So yeah, I mean, those specific moments are completely inaccessible. So just putting some, what's the word I'm looking for? Putting some energy the other way and ensuring that young people can access live music moments, access to the best acts in the UK is something I enjoy a lot.
And it's totally inspirational for them too. You know, yeah. The podcast is all about seeing other people thinking I can do that. You know, people hopefully will see you and think I can do that, and that's like inspiring a generation. And when they go and see live music, they see, oh, I'd love to do that.
Yeah.
And some of them will.
100%. I mean, my first live music show was Jay-Z, Kanye, Watch the Throne.
Wow.
Oh man, it literally blew my mind watching Jay-Z and Kanye float on these lit up cubes. Es Devlin was the stage designer.
Yeah.
I met her randomly in person one day in Old Street.
Wow.
But it literally just made me think, if this is possible, then what is possible?
Yeah.
So yeah, live music can definitely do that.
That is a marriage of music and the art of it. You know, the staging has now become so incredible that you're just watching two guys. They would have been fine. Yeah, Kanye and Jay-Z just rapping on stage would have been fine, but it's so much more than that.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Definitely took the experience to another level. And you probably saw set design, stage design go up a notch for live music shows post, I don't know if it's Kanye's influence or Jay-Z's influence, but it definitely felt like it became more of a prominent thing at live music shows.
Yeah.
Costs a lot of money.
Yep.
A hell of a lot of money. But yeah, definitely a combination or merge between music and arts.
Yeah. We'll come back to that because it's an amazing thing you do, and I want to hear more. But I want to hear a bit more about you to start with. We talked about you grew up in Southeast London.
Yeah, South East London.
Woolwich, you said.
Woolwich.
Is your ends. So tell me what it's like growing up in Southeast London. You know, what was it like for you?
Growing up in Southeast London was cool. I think the age in which I grew up in Southeast London, or the time I should say, was one where I think kids could still be kids in a strange way. I'm a millennial, so I grew up without the internet and then the internet just emerging.
Mm-hmm.
So kids were kids. I remember playing outside, kicking footballs in the park, trying to score goals, running races, climbing trees. That's what it was like.
You didn't have Sky TV?
I didn't.
Oh, right. No. Okay. Sky TV
didn't
existed.
Come until later. Yeah. Sky TV came in my teenage years.
Oh, okay.
And I think what is really interesting with Sky TV, because my mum was very adamant on not getting the full packages because she thought it'd be a distraction. She was very much a traditional Nigerian mum.
Okay.
Focus on your education and nothing else.
And did you?
yeah, it's really interesting. I think in my early years of education, I was very, very diligent as a student.
Yeah.
And it was incredible as a result of incredible work that my mum, my aunties, my uncles did, the work that they did to ensure that I was excelling in education.
Yeah.
Especially because I have dyslexia. I remember my auntie making me sit down for hours on end to read things.
When did you find out you were dyslexic?
Later on in life.
But oh, right. So
at the time.
Okay. It was just hard work. You just need to work harder.
Yeah. I just need to work harder. And I excelled from an education perspective when I was younger. In my teenage years, going into secondary school, there was lots of distractions and challenges because as young adolescent boys, you begin to... Testosterone begins to...
You begin to be a young adolescent boy.
Yes, yes, yes. And then, you know, I don't think postcode wars were fully fledged at the time, but it was noticeable to me how territorial life became, and all of a sudden I was hyper-conscious of where I lived, where I went to school, and who else lived in other areas and went to school in other areas, and that caused its own challenges. Inevitably, I was permanently excluded from school.
All right.
So
at what age?
This was in year 11, so maybe, what's that, 16?
15, 16.
But I have to thank my head teacher, Miss Jaffe, and I've thanked her multiple times.
Not many people thank their head teacher when they've been permanently excluded from school. So.
Well, I deserved it. I won't lie. I deserved it. But
is that in reflection, or did you think so at the time?
No, I thought so at the time. But, you know, with me, I always thought that I could slip and slide
and
get myself out of a rough spot. But I definitely deserved it. But she definitely gave me a chance because even though I had been permanently excluded, she allowed me to do my GCSEs.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And, you know, minus GCSEs, who knows where I would have gone because it kind of forces your...
Down paths, yeah.
Forces your life down a particular path.
So I presume you did them and did okay?
I did them, okay, went to college.
Okay.
Went to...
So even though you were excluded, actually you didn't get excluded from education. That was just like a little bump along the way.
Yeah.
Just on that, you know, you've learned from it. What difference do you think that had made to you, the experience of going through that at that age?
Exclusion?
Yeah.
It's
a terrible word, by the way.
Yeah, I know. And also really relevant for, you know, exclusion rates now in the country and,
exactly,
you know, the potential futures that we could be ruining through exclusion. But I think exclusion taught me something about where I wanted to be and where I didn't want to be quite early on.
Yeah.
But I think my ability to see that also was a weird one because I had, my uncle was, he was a pastor, he was a philosopher, he was a solicitor. And I remember the conversations he used to have with me were really esoterical, but allowed me to kind of see myself outside of myself.
Right.
So, and always think about what I wanted for myself. So I remember being in the, I think it was the pupil referral unit where you get excluded, but you still have to come to the thing every day.
Right.
And I was around other kids and I could sense in myself that I was very different to those other kids.
Yeah.
Not from a judgmental perspective, but just that I was different. So... going through that experience made me think, actually, I don't want to be here. I am here as a consequence of my actions, but I actually don't want to be here.
Yeah.
So the allowing me to do my GCSEs was actually a lifeline.
Wow.
Because it allowed me to take them seriously.
Yeah.
And then go to college, which, again, allowed me to then pursue education on that kind of...
Get on that track.
Get on that track.
Which is, that's really fascinating. Did you like school?
Not really. I would say I'm a doer, creative. And, you know, a lot of people are talking about it now, the constraining nature of classrooms for creative brains. But I definitely would say I'm a creative brain, and sitting in classrooms for 8 hours.
Didn't work for you.
Yeah, it didn't work for me. Deep down, I knew it didn't work for me.
But the world's always going to come to you, right? So, because that's only a short period of time, and then you're going to move on to doing other things. Before we against that was you're in school that you don't love in South London or South East London. Was race ever a factor? Because it would have been fairly representative in Woolwich, I presume.
Yeah, I would say in moments, not like prevalent, or maybe I didn't see it because, you know, now I know what I know it's ever present. But I think, you know, from the school I went to the area I lived in, people tried to be as progressive as possible. I remember run-ins with neighbours who would spout racist things in anger or in passing. Yeah, I would say it was there, present.
It was there, but it's not a thing that was weighing on your mind. It was just a thing that's there, and let me just get on with my life and doing what I'm doing. So you go to college. What did you do from there?
So I went to college and then went to University of Reading to study electrical engineering and computer science.
Nice.
My mum was beside herself, absolutely elated that I was following the traditional educational path.
Well, as a parent, I know that you think, oh, I wonder where this is going to go. Yeah. And actually for you to then end up doing, you know, A-levels or beta or whatever you did equivalent, and then ending up at university, it's like, yay!
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's quite interesting because I remember a moment when I was permanently excluded. Obviously, I was getting excluded up until that point.
Yeah.
But every time I got excluded, I remember my mum saying, like, she would shout at me and, you know, sometimes I get a clip around the ears. But when I got permanently excluded, she was very, very somber, almost like accepting of my fate. And that stayed with me more than her clipping me around the ears or shouting at me, because it was almost like she was like, well, this is the life you chose. This is the life you chose. And I remember that. So going to university and doing those things was kind of like a tick box for me from her perspective. Was a tick box for me, for her.
Yeah.
To say, you know, I'm not falling off the rails. I made it. However, I did drop out in my second year.
Yeah.
Because
it's not for you, right?
It's not for me. It's definitely not for me. To an extent, I would love to go back and finish.
Oh, really?
Yeah, my electrical engineering and computer science degree, I'd love to go back and finish. But just because it's like a point of unfinished business.
Unfinished business.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So not necessarily because you want it, because you've got unfinished business with that.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. But the clearly, even just talking to you now, is there something about you that's very much doer, making things happen? Formal environments like that are probably not where you're going to be at your best, right?
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree. Definitely. I just need a open space and some tools and, yeah.
Yeah, something to run with. And I bet your parents kind of knew that anyway, right? Like you said about your mum, you know your own children. You're like, yeah. That's probably why she was elated when you did it. She's thinking, I was never thought that was going to happen. But she'll know you're going to be successful because you've got something about you.
Yeah, I would say that my mum definitely knows my nature, for sure. She always used to say to me, because of my ability to talk my way out of a situation, she said, you'll either be a lawyer or you'll be some sort of salesman.
Yeah.
But she also saw the way that I would, like, take remote controls apart and then put them together again. And I was very, very just, like, get into things and do things. So, yeah, she definitely knew my nature, for sure.
I mean, what, you know, I'm from Nigerian background also, so I'm very clear on what my parents wanted me to be, a doctor, like most Nigerian parents, you know, a lawyer, that would be good too, you know, accountant.
Engineer.
Accountant, engineer, good, engineer, you know,
yeah.
Pastor, yeah, good, yeah. You know. What do you think your parents wanted for you? Or your mum specifically, because you talk about your mum a lot.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I think I don't think it was linked to any specific role in general. I think it was more linked to stability, respect, and anything that kind of gave me that. That's probably what she wanted for me. That's probably what she wanted for all of us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and I've been asking this a lot, and it's really interesting because a lot of the people in the podcast have been a little bit older than you. And I'm really interested in the perspective of change. So, like, my parents, when I was young, they said, you know, whether they said twice as hard or three times as hard, they said, you're going to have to work hard if you're going to make it, you know, because you need that there are barriers. They didn't necessarily say race. So you need to be at the top to be sure, and therefore you're going to have to work harder. What did your parents tell you about the future and or race and how you would have to encounter it? Or did they tell you anything at all?
So I remember my uncle telling me, having a conversation with me about race. But broadly, they didn't have a conversation with me about race in relation to how hard I would work.
Mm.
But I do remember them talking about and instilling in me a sense of like doing things properly and doing it well and showing up on time. My uncle's massive on showing up on time, which is hilarious because I turned up late today, which makes me feel...
But you don't like being late.
Yeah, though. I don't like being late. But that's because of what he instilled in me in such a young age. And it was always about respecting other people's time and, you know, ensuring that things run properly.
Mm.
And I remember he taught me the lesson in the way you iron a shirt.
All right.
And it stayed with me. And he was like, you can iron a shirt and just like do a once over.
Mm.
But you if you follow the seams and follow the lines, you get every single crease. And I remember ironing meticulously, practicing to the point where I actually loved ironing.
Do you still?
Yeah, I still iron, of course.
But do you still love it?
I see it more as a formality these days, not a hobby. But yeah, I remember him using the analogy of ironing and shirts, and I remember he was like, "Yeah, you can iron a shirt, or you can do it meticulously, every seam. You know, turn over the collar, do the inside, do the the back at the top of the inside." Yeah, I just remember it. But that was the kind of blueprint that they followed for the way that I work. Do it properly, do it well, and be diligent, show up.
So that was not just ironing shirts. That was an analogy for how you needed to show up as an individual.
Yeah.
You know, is there anything else they told you? Any other words of wisdom or anything they told you that stayed with you?
Any words of wisdom? Yeah, I think the biggest thing was, I think it was my mum that taught me, but she was always, because I always used to get in trouble protecting other people.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was always like, that doesn't sit right. So I'd get involved in something and then that would lead to something. But I remember my mum saying to me, you know, a lot of bad things can happen because you're in the wrong place.
Mm.
And it gave me a level of discernment around what I did and where I went as a young person. Mm. Like there'll be people who be like, "Oh, we're going to this party," and I'll be like, "If I go, then there might be these people who are going to go, and that might end up, you know, causing trouble." I remember seeing that a lot in my youth because people would be like, "Oh, I went to this party, but it kicked off, and somebody got hurt, and blah blah blah," and I was like, "I knew, not to go." But it also saved me from a lot of other things, like making decisions in moments. Like if you do that, like what's going to happen as a consequence of doing that? If you go there, what's going to happen as a consequence of going there? So yeah, my mum definitely taught me that.
That's some pretty serious wisdom, because you know you normally learn by being in the wrong place.
Mm.
But actually, you're getting ahead of that, of saying actually I'm trying to work out what the wrong place would be, so I don't end up in there in the first place. I don't have to learn the hard way.
Yeah,
I'll learn in advance of that. So.
I still made wrong decisions because I feel like you ultimately the learning is like solidified and entrenched through making your own mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the guidance helped me make less of those mistakes for sure.
Yeah, for sure. And it kind of just helps to be able to make those decisions, right? Some young kids can't. They just bundle from one issue to another, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you're thinking you did as well. In fact, you know, what do you think, you know, it's really interesting talking to you about these formative years and knowing what you've gone on to do. Were there traits that you were showing as the younger version of you that you think, that was it? Was it impatience or hard work or focus that actually now have led to you being successful in some of the stuff that you've done?
Yeah, I think when I loved something, I was hyper-focused on it.
Right.
Like music. I remember growing up in the church, I would play keyboard and drums, and I was hyper-focused on that at a young age. I remember that. And then...
What does hyper-focus mean to you? What's that?
Just like thought about it all the time.
Yeah.
I thought about it. I remember playing the keyboard in my room for maybe 4 hours straight.
Wow.
After school, learning Furzelese. But yeah, that's the kind of hyper focus I'm talking about. Just like, you can't think about anything else and dreaming about the thing. And that's kind of how it's transcended into now. Because when I'm in something, it's like the thoughts about it will race into my brain in the moment where I'm still.
Yeah.
So yeah, I would say that's probably one of the things that...
This sort of hyper focus, you know, when you're... And does that mean that you're prepared... When you're in hyper focus, you're prepared to do anything, work as hard as, like you said, practice, focus, do what you need to master that thing?
Yeah, I think as I've grown older, what I've learned is it's more about the commitment to the thing rather than mastering it. Because in some instances, I can't do everything in relation to that thing.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as I'm committed to it and stay the course, I can partner with people, work with people, employ people, ask people for help, all of those things, but in aid of this thing. But I think more it's about the commitment to the thing rather than an absolute mastery of that thing.
Okay.
In some instances, I might be able to master it because there's things that are within my control. And in others, it's just how do I partner with people to ensure that I stay the course?
So it's about the end goal. Well, it's about two things. There is staying the course, which is incredibly important in achievement of anything, because you can't achieve if you don't stay the course. But it's also something about understanding what you're good at and where you can add value and what other people... So, and what the edge of that is, and so where other people can bring their value in too.
Yeah. And I learned that it wasn't innate. I learned that because right at the very beginning of my journey, even in doing what I'm doing now, I tried to do everything.
Yeah.
And failed because I tried to do everything.
Yeah.
And it was just, you know, normally, I don't know if it's normal, but I think most people's natural instinct is to try and do it themselves. Mm. But then realizing that actually there were shortfalls in my capability, knowledge to do everything. So working with others was the best approach. Still committed to the course and staying the course, but working with others was the best approach.
I mean, probably you don't realize it, but there's an incredible amount of self-awareness in that. You know, a lot of people don't understand for a while that they can't do it all and they do need other people. And actually one of the big failures of people in leadership is that they think they can do it all and they don't value that actually it's okay that they can only do so much. And they allow other people to bring their skills and their brilliance to make the whole.
Yeah, 100%. And I can't take the entirety of the credit for that self-awareness.
Yeah, you can.
I would, but I know that my mentors and coaches would be watching me. But I think they definitely helped me to realize that. And in certain instances, forced me to realize that. And, you know, I probably could have meandered around my purpose trying to do it myself, but to really supercharge the speed and the focus and the quality, they were like, you're gonna have to step change and work with other people. And then you have to realize that actually you trying to do it all yourself, partly a control thing and, you know, trying to make sure everything gets done perfectly, but, you know, also trying to prove to yourself that nothing's beyond your reach.
Yeah.
Or your capability.
Yeah. So it was going to be a question for later. I'm going to ask it now around because you've brought it up. Mentors, coaching, sponsorship. When did you realize that was an important thing for you to have? How did you go about getting them and what differences have they made to you?
Let me start with the difference that they made to me. Huge. And it's a weird one because instinctively I always knew that I needed a mentor. I remember when I was younger in school and I'd hang around with a lot of the older kids to help me understand like how do you navigate this space that is school?
Mm.
Like what's the do's and don'ts? The FAQs? What should I do? And I actually remember it was to the point where a couple of my age mates were like, why do you spend so much time with the older kids? And I was like, I'm just learning, picking up things. So that was always the way that I operate, very observant, spend lots of time with elders. But then I guess I realized I needed one when I was on the hunt for information. And I was trying to figure out how I do what I do.
Yeah.
And I think it was like a YouTube video that was like, get yourself a mentor. Somebody was like, get yourself a mentor, the impact of mentors, the value of mentors.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, all right, cool, I'll get a mentor. And then I was like trying to find one. And it's so funny because this is how I met one of my key mentors.
Right.
I was searching and there was a guy called Gary Trousdale. And Gary Trousdale is an incredible human being. He created something called Spirit for London, which is... Right. Actually kind of similar to what Limitless is at the moment, but a different dynamic. And he created Spirit of London, a massive music show that was at the O2, had Labyrinth, blah, blah, blah.
He
was mentoring another gentleman and also running a charity. And I remember that I reached out to Gary, not even sure how, maybe his website, maybe LinkedIn at the time, I'm not sure.
Mm.
And Gary came back to me, very generously, because you know nobody owes you a response, but Gary Trousdale came back to me and he was like, look, super, super busy, can't mentor you, but I think you should meet this person.
Mm-hmm.
And he put me in contact with a guy called Viv Amoon. And Viv has been a mainstay. He's been foundational, fundamental into my growth as both, I'd say a social entrepreneur, a young man, a businessman.
Yeah,
been incredible. And also a black man.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. So you're looking up and seeing someone who looks like you doing stuff that you want to do.
Yeah.
It's pretty inspirational, isn't it?
Yeah. But also doing it in the way that I want to do it.
Right.
Because I think he would describe himself as an ethical business leader, strategic, futurist, X, Y, Z, Z, Z. But, you know, he's almost the community activist.
Right.
Because he's very involved in, you know, strategically bettering the black community across London, across the UK, in fact, even in the globally, I would say. But yeah, that as well was also a massive draw. I didn't know that at the time.
Yeah.
Gary introduced me to him, but I found that out through inquisitive questioning and finding out about him, which is how I kind of knew it was a fit at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, just to underpin, it's fundamental mentorship to growth.
Yeah, you know. And what would you say to young kids, my daughter's 20, going to be 21 soon, about getting them, how to go about doing it? Because I think one of the issues is, I mean, I talk a lot about scaffolding, and scaffolding is all the things that help you grow to be the person you can be. And mentoring, sponsorship, those two things, you cannot have a career of any type, you cannot do it without those things.
Mm.
It's impossible. Can't be done, right? And a great network also helps your career to thrive, you know. But a lot of kids, certainly from certain backgrounds, don't get that or understand that or know how to go about making that happen. What advice would you give to them?
I think understanding why you want that mentor, because that clarity in why you want them gives clarity to everything that you say and ask. I think clarity in what you're asking of them, that is super, super helpful. And I also think offering something in return. I know I've had this conversation recently around mentorship and how it should be free and with no strings attached, but I actually think in a world where people are so busy doing lots of different things, if you can offer something else in exchange, even if it's just time, I'll come every Friday or an hour where you can just help out in your business or your office, or you know, write some emails for you or help with an event. I think that's very demonstrative of a value exchange.
Yes.
So I think that's really useful. But I think clarity is the big thing, because some people go up to people and like, hey, I want you to be my mentor and you're doing amazing things and I just want to be around you. But there's no clarity as to how that person can engage.
Yeah.
So they're almost trying to figure it out. And that is work in itself outside of the mentoring. So I think clarity in why you want that. Yeah.
So, but to do that, do you have to have clarity of what you want to do? Because it's very hard to ask someone to help you with something if you don't know where that help's going to project you and propel you. So you have to do two things. You have to try and get some clarity about where your direction And then you can then say to the person who's mentoring, I want to go over there, therefore, can I get this from you?
Yeah, that definitely helps. I'd say that that's amazing, definitely helps. I'd say it's not fundamental though.
Okay.
Because I would say most 20, 21 year olds are figuring out what they
want. Yeah, for sure.
And also they might pivot. But I think it, with mentorship, it's about learning the core set of skills around a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So in my case with Viv, it was like, how do I, and this is what I was coming to Gary Charles though around, is like, how do I take what's in my head and position it down on paper so other people can understand it? How do I clarify it, crystallize it, make it, package it in the things that make sense so I can, that's the ask I was coming with. And that's what they helped me with. But that skill set helped me in a lot of other things too. It wasn't industry or role specific. It was a core skill set. And I think because I was so specific, that's probably why.
They were able to do it.
And then it blossomed into lots of other things. But that specificity really helps, I think, outside of what you think you want to do. It's helpful if you do know.
Yeah.
Because then you can be really prescriptive. But I wouldn't say it's foundational.
And actually, I would say, you know, in the mentoring relationships I've had, actually just having the conversations just helps. Mm. And actually, the key thing is the ability for the two people to relate to each other, you know, and so it can spin off into lots of other directions. So you're very specific about that thing, but even when you're specific about one thing, just it's like us having a conversation now. We could say this is specifically about this, but I can tell you now already we've talked about a lot of things I wasn't expecting us to talk about, right?
Yeah.
You know, and so the conversation is its own reward often.
100%. That is, we should double down on that. The conversation is its own reward. Because I think at the moment, people can be hyper-transactional. They go into a thing and they're like, okay, what can we do?
Yeah.
Like, what can you give me? What can I give you? And what they don't know is that so many things can emerge through just a conversation.
Yeah.
And I think just as a skill set and a habit, it's probably something that's got lost.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And actually, I think, again, going way off track, COVID didn't help because getting together face-to-face, you know, because being on Zoom, for example, totally fine, better than nothing, 100%, but makes it slightly more transactional. We've got an hour. The hour is very set and, it becomes transactional, whereas what we've lost is that, look, come and see me half an hour, but we thought we were going to talk about this. We ended up talking about that, you know, and I didn't know you were even interested in that. Well, you know, we just got there and that's it. Or, you know, you say something that you didn't think was going to be important to that person, but it turns out to be the most important thing they heard.
Yeah.
So if you'd put a list of things that you wanted to talk about, that wouldn't have been on it. But actually, that's the one thing they took away. So you're right. I'll write that down. That's the pearl of wisdom. The conversation is its own reward.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. And I think as well with mentorship, because going into what we just discussed, building transformational mentorship relationships rather than transactional is the key for me.
How would you define that difference?
Well, I think it's more about like if I admire you for what you've achieved and where you've been and the things that you've experienced, instead of coming to you, specificity is important to say, this is what I want to learn, but this is not what I want. Like, it's not like a tick box and it's like a, when you're going to give it to me. It's just like, this is what I want to learn, but I just want to go along with you for the rest of your journey to learn it.
Yeah.
That's transformational.
Yeah.
Because so much more comes out of it. So many different opportunities come out of it rather than like, hey, I want X, Y, Z. And it's like, yeah, I know you're busy, but can you give me X, Y, Z? And it's like, it's been 6 weeks. Can you give me X, Y, Z? And it's been 6 months. Because then you're missing out on the nuance and the things that surround you as a human being that's really valuable from a learning perspective. So I would say transformational outside of transactional.
Nice. Superb. Totally brilliant. Totally brilliant. So you leave school, you drop out of university. What then?
I leave school, I drop out of university, and then I started something called The Opinion UK. It was actually Jamal Edwards, Rest His Soul, who inspired me to do it.
Did you know Jamal?
No.
All right. Another inspirational character, though. You know, just shows you, I've always said quickly on Jamal, you don't have to be 60 or 70 or 80 to be inspirational, right?
Yeah.
You're inspirational.
I appreciate that. But Jamal was incredible and his story was incredible, and the way that his story was platformed was incredible, because I'm sure he inspired a generation of entrepreneurs.
100%.
But what he was able to do with YouTube, I was like, well, I can do that. So, but I had my own little twist on it, because I was very cognizant very early on that the way I was able to articulate myself, the way I was able to navigate various spaces, allowed me to have a different path than my friendship groups.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I was like, well, hold on a second. I can talk about, you know, the challenges that CEOs, managing directors have overcome to be successful in the workplace, and then take that content back into my community. Mm. So the Opinion UK was essentially around that. It was about interviewing influential people, talking, documenting their story, and then putting it on YouTube.
Hey, I remember it's a bit like my podcast.
Yeah. Well, and this was, I don't even know when this was, maybe 2011, 2012.
Okay.
And I just remember my mum going, yeah, it just better make money. And I was like, okay. it didn't make money, but it was a good learning curve for me. Everything around like production and managing different people, stakeholders, all of that good stuff, good for business. And then it transformed almost into like a makeshift consultancy,
right,
called LFA, which was Limitless Future Achievements.
Okay.
And LFA, because when I was doing the Opinion UK, I remember I sat down with the managing director, I think he worked in finance, and he was just like, oh, like, I really want people like you in my business. And I was like, well, there's loads of people like me in your business. I can connect you if you want.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, actually, maybe there are people in businesses that want to connect from people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds, underrepresented backgrounds, mm-hmm. But don't have access. So that became my purpose, and Limitless Future Achievements was the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was tough because, you know, I was essentially doing recruitment, and recruitment's tough.
Yeah.
Really tough.
Pretty much everything is tough.
Everything's tough, but recruitment's tough. Recruitment's really tough. And I remember I was working in a bar, and I was a bartender for about 5 years, even while I was pursuing this goal.
Mm.
And a woman walked in who I used to go to college with.
Mm-hmm.
Her name is Jessica, but I won't say her last name. But Jessica's incredible because she also forms a pivotal part in that journey.
Okay.
But Jessica came into the bar. We're chatting. She's like, oh my God, it's great to see you. And then we start chatting. She's like, what are you up to? And I'm like, I'm here at the bar, but I also run this thing called LFA. It's all about blah, blah, blah. And she's like, oh my God, I'm the EA to the head of talent at Group M. Group M is like it's a media agency.
A big media advertising marketing agency.
It's under WPP.
Yeah.
So I'm like, great. She's like, I'll get you a meeting with my boss and you can talk about what you do. So she did that. And then I went to speak to the head of talent at Group M, and they were like, I love what you do. Let's try and work together. So we did. And that completely step changed my career, because as a consequence of having Group M as a client, I was able to walk into other doors and use that as a calling card and so on and so forth. And in that, in getting signing Group M as a client, I ended up meeting Jonathan Akway, who is now the president of Publicis, Alex Goat, who is the CEO of Liberty, mm-hmm. Laura Jordan Bambach, who's the founder of an agency, but I can't remember what it's called, Daniel Ife in Dakar, and Nadia Powell, who's my business partner now. Mm-hmm. So, and that's when we started the Great British Diversity Experiment. So, you know, windy road.
Yeah, windy road leads back, though, to that conversation with that lady in that time. You know, but that's still about networks and telling people what you're doing, and then leaning forward and taking those meetings, right?
Yeah, 100%, 100%. It was all about network, and I was very, very adamant about building my network, but that was kind of an innocuous meeting of somebody coming into a bar that I worked in that I used to go to school with, who was the EA to the head of talent at Group M.
You still got to be ready, though. You still got to be, you know, some people are ready and some people aren't ready. And so when that moment comes, my dad always say, opportunities pass, they don't pause, right? And so your job is to be ready for when you see it and then take it.
Yeah, 100%. And it's really funny you used to talk about being ready, because one of the things that Viv taught me was, you can have a great idea, but people only have 30 seconds to hear it. So you've got to package it up in 30 seconds. You've got to know, you've got to have a script that's tight in 30 seconds. And I remember I mastered that script and she came into the bar. We're probably chatting while she's ordering a drink. I told her what I did in that 30 seconds. She was like, ah, I know who to connect you to. So yeah, people call it elevator pitch now, of course. Only they've always called it elevator pitch. I don't know why I'm describing an elevator pitch.
It's some ancient piece of technology. It's always been called that. Yeah,
it's always been called that. But yeah, he just taught me the importance of the elevator pitch.
Yeah, because you don't know when you're going to need it. You don't know when to be ready, and if it takes too long, people are like, you know, I've got to go and get that drink. Bye. See ya.
Yeah.
And if that had happened, nothing would have happened from it, would it? You know. So I kind of get it. So all these serendipitous things are happening. You're meeting these amazing people. You're starting these businesses. Clearly within that, there's lots of setbacks too, right?
Yeah.
How do you lean into or deal with setbacks? What's your mindset around setbacks?
To be brutally honest, just keep going.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember... like I had this massive idea around this like massive recruitment fair, and like it was a good idea, but it wasn't good in practice, and there was multiple other things that were like it. I was adamant that I could, you know, get in the space and make my own thing.
Yeah.
And I remember it got to a point where I was like, this isn't going to happen. But I probably felt demoralized for like a week, and I was like, just keep going, do something else, figure it out, put a spin on it, pivot, what's new, what could be unique. So I think that's it. I think that's just the at the heart of it. Just keep going. Just keep going.
You know, listening to you, I hear the just keep going, and I hear the resilience and the determination. But I also hear this incredible ability to pivot, to change. Right, I was going there. That was going around. I'm going to do this. I'm going here. You're not just, correct me if I'm wrong, you're not just banging one idea against a brick wall and coming up with no and just keeping going. You're thinking, hang on, I'm getting a no. Maybe I need to change it and pivot. I've heard you use the word a lot. It's clearly a really important part of the way you operate.
100%. It's not easy. And I think I probably do it out of discomfort. Like I get to a place where it's just not working for me and I'm just like, I need to... just do something different. I need to just try something different, go into a new space, or just switch things up in my friendship groups, or just do something.
Yeah.
But it's vitally, vitally, vitally important, I would say, pivoting.
100%.
Yeah. 100%.
It's the superpower of most super successful people.
Yeah. And I remember it was confirmed to me, even though it was like an innate thing, it was confirmed to me when I watched The Black Godfather on Netflix. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't.
Oh, it's incredible.
All right.
It follows the life of a guy called Clarence Avant, and he was the Black Godfather. He was found fundamentally crucial. He played an important role in lots of successful careers, politically and from an entertainment perspective.
Right.
But he said a line in the documentary that followed his life. He's now passed. God bless his soul, but he talked about how like what's got you to this particular stage is not going to get you to the next stage. And that was like, that's kind of what I've learned over time, that you have to fundamentally pivot, change, to try and do things differently or get to new ground. But yeah, you definitely have to pivot.
Yeah. I think that's another one to add to my humongous list of things to watch on Netflix, right?
Yeah, Netflix.
Sure, it's Netflix and not one of the others.
I'm sure. I won't make you get a bogus subscription.
Yeah, well, no, I've already got. Look, I've got every subscription. I literally have them all. But yeah, I think it's really, really important that this whole idea of that what got you here isn't what will get you there. Sometimes, especially in a skill, but sometimes it is the thing that will get you there in terms of characteristics. So determination. For example, if you're determined, that gets you most places you want to go. But skill-wise, sometimes you have to pivot, you have to change, you have to look at things, and you've got to take disappointment. But that's why I ask about the character traits when you're a child. Some people have the traits that they use when they're 80. They were there when they were six. Right?
Yeah.
They were just there. And their parents were like, I knew that they would do it because that's the person they are.
Yeah.
You know.
100%. And those are kind of like golden threads, the stubbornness, the determination.
Correct.
But it's funny because I would describe myself as like stubbornly malleable. It's that weird because I will always, or I've always got my ears open.
Yeah.
To wise counsel. And if somebody has been there, done it, or, you know, has some like useful insight, my ears are always open. So I'm like, okay, great. And I know that I want to do this, but I've got to pivot. I've got to change. I've got to adapt. I can't do this. It might get to that stage, but I've always got my ears open.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think I'm right. Of all the things you're doing or have been doing on this journey so far, what's the thing you're most proud of? Yep. You can pivot the question if you want.
No, I don't want to pivot the question. I think the thing I'm most proud of is staying true to who I am.
Okay.
Even in spite of the different things that I've done. Because I started out always wanting to help people, and I think you can get to various stages and walk in various rooms where it becomes apparent that there's lots of opportunities that could benefit you and you alone.
Mm-hmm.
And you can chase those. But for me, it's always been important that as part of what I do, there is some like wraparound impact for other people.
Right.
You could call it, I don't know, survivor's mission, purpose. But I think that's the one thing that I'm particularly proud of, because it would be easy to run away with the skill set that I have and, you know, pursue a career in finance. Actually, I don't know if I could pursue a career.
I don't think
in
you finance. Can.
No.
Trust me, even this short period of talking, no.
No, I don't think I could, but, you know, pursue some other career that would have riches at the end of that particular rainbow. But I definitely think that, you know, it gives me an immense amount of joy, but staying true to that, helping other people while I also achieve and attain some sort of success is definitely being what I'm the proudest of. Because I've seen other examples of people who are massively successful, but it's almost like this vacuous, empty vessel. It's just, you know, and they're almost looking for that thing as well. You know, you attain a certain amount of success or finances, and then you look to philanthropy to sort of give it back in some way, shape or form to have some sort of impact. But I think I've managed to marry the two.
Yeah, no, I think you have. And it's great that you say that, given that you work with, you know, some incredible brands. I mean, we got linked because my friend saw you when he was at P&G, I think it was and I'm like, working with P&G is like, Jesus, that's like the gold star, double gold star. So it's interesting, you didn't say, working with these amazing brands like Coca-Cola and P&G and all of that stuff. So it's good that said it. But how has it been? Your route isn't traditionally through big corporates, yet you have these big corporate clients. How is working with those sort of organizations?
It's great. It's amazing. Especially because I'm on the outside in.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, within every corporate organization, it has its own culture, its own politics, its own hierarchy. But I get to work with them as a consultant and be their confidants, their close allies and their co-conspirators in many ways, in many scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
So it's amazing, but not without its challenges and difficulties, because what we do specifically in relation to culture change requires behavioral change. And behavioral change is one of the hardest things that you can do to a person, but also within a business. Or
almost impossible for an organization. So, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It certainly takes a long time.
Yes. And I think that is the key thing, time. It's probably one of the biggest challenges. And I think the challenge is actually patience. Because when you know something is the right thing to do and you know the benefits that could happen as a consequence of doing that thing, having to wait 2 or 3 years for an organization to turn the wheel to do the thing.
Yeah.
Breeds frustration and needs patience. That's probably the harder part of working with those big organizations. But I think the better parts of it is the impact that you can have.
Mm-hmm.
A small tweak, a small adjustment, educating and enlightening and creating behavioral change with key stakeholders in the organization creates massive swirls of change for everybody else that's in the organization that potentially doesn't have influence or access to those stakeholders. It's a beautiful thing to be able to do it on scale.
Yeah, yeah. And to do it around something you're passionate about, you know, disadvantaged communities and ethnic minorities, you know. So if we use that to take us on to, you know, what I call kind of the main issue, right? Mm. So this is about race at the top. This is about advancement or creating more representation of people of color in leadership and those sort of areas. Just asking about, I was going to say, do you think it exists? So that seems like a silly question, right? So let's go to the bias in organizations for ethnicity and race exists.
You
spend a lot of time with massive organizations talking about it. Why do you think it exists and what can we do to address it?
Well, I mean, bias, you know, if you want to go to as far as saying racism, sexism, homophobia, all of these things, do they exist in the organization? Yes. Why do they exist? The reason why they exist in organizations is because they exist in society.
Yeah.
I always, you know, you go into an organization, they almost like trying to separate themselves from what's happening in our wider society. But, you know, society is made out of human beings and, mm-hmm. and businesses are made out of human beings.
Yeah.
So if you take
not for much longer.
Well, yeah.
I'm joking, everyone. I had to throw an AI thing in there. No, you please carry on.
This podcast is sponsored by AI.
Open AI.
But yeah, you know, businesses are made up of people and people have innate biases. We all have them.
Mm-hmm.
Every single human being has them regardless of their color and creed. So when you think about racism within a business, of course it exists because it exists in society. Now, maybe not to the extent of like extreme macro racism,
mm-hmm.
but the almost symptoms and consequences and manifestations of racism at that level exist within the business.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. So you're just saying businesses are just a reflection of...
Yeah, microcosm
of society. Yeah, of society. And whilst it exists in society, then it always exists there.
Yeah.
Well, the issue with that is I think it will always exist in society. So are we saying that it's always going to be in businesses?
Good question. I think the first way to mitigate against it is the acceptance. Most businesses are fighting the acceptance that exists in their businesses. Yeah. So therefore, they're operating under this pretense that, oh, we're better than we are. And we know from every study that, you know, the people who say that they're the least biased are the most biased. So the fundamental acceptance of that allows you to see it in the way that it manifests itself. Even if you take systems and processes, for example, most systems and processes have been adopted over hundreds of years. I think the interview was invented by Thomas Edison. It's essentially,
with a light bulb.
Yeah. And I think it's essentially a likability contest because you sit in front of a person and you're like, how much do I like you?
Yeah, yeah.
But how much does bias play a role
we must in do. That?
Of course it does. Of course it does. And if you kind of looked at that, you would say that actually it's impossible for it not to seep into those systems. It's impossible for it not to breed in our organization and be ever present.
So in the work that you do with organizations, where's your area of focus into trying to, let's be clear, your point is a good one. If it's always going to be in society, it's always going to be in business. But the key is to try and not eradicate it, but make it less effective or marginalize it. The organizations can do that, will do the best because they will have they'll be open to diverse talent and people, business around people. So the better the people, the more diverse you're open to, the better the people you'll get.
Yeah.
So what do you focus on with these organizations to try and get them to be in a better place?
I think the number one thing is insight data.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some of the data poverty within organizations is unnecessary.
Mm-hmm.
I know there are complications with gathering data in various regions across Europe and the world, but you have to have an understanding of, one, the makeup of your business. And I know there are legal constraints, but we've done lots of work with lots of clients to get around those legal constraints. Getting an understanding of how your people are feeling, Engagement surveys are great. Most businesses run them. But, you know, if you have 80% engagement in your business, that's fantastic. But what are happening to the 20% that aren't engaged? So you have to get to the nuance of that to get a really high productive team. So data and insight is fundamental to that. I think there is definitely an element around leadership understanding the journey and getting a grasp of inclusive leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, name one thing that's not driven from the top. In a business.
There is nothing.
There is nothing. So inclusion can't be something that's like handled or driven by middle management across the business. It has to be driven from leadership. But I think the critical thing is helping leaders understand their role. And in every single leadership dynamic I've gone in, that's been missing as we've begun the journey and become clearer as we've begun the journey itself.
What is their role then? As
yeah, I mean, you know... The role, if I was going to lean on Deloitte's inclusive leadership traits, 6 E's, is commitment, collaboration, cognizance of bias, cultural intelligence, all those things. That's their role. Developing those skills is their role. I think, one, understanding how they will drive change with those attributes, because we're all different. The way that you're going to show up and drive change is going to be different to the way that I show up and drive change. It's helping it feel authentic to them, mm-hmm. because the discomfort around inclusion, race, sexism, homophobia comes from people not understanding the way that they're going to show up around that conversation.
Yeah.
And feeling that the way they show up has to be this perfect, like, mechanical type of, like, perfectly delivered speech or language or sentence. You know, you're going to make mistakes in your own way, but you can also have deep impact in your own way as a leader too. So I think that's quite important. I also think there's a thing around ensuring that you bring people along on the journey.
Yeah.
And that goes to like ERGs, but also the wider people in your business. And, you know, we talk a lot about capability building, not training, because capability building is helping people understand the capability that they need to build, the specific capability that they need to build. Now, part of that will form training mm-hmm. and level understanding, but it will look very different for a people leader than it will for, you know, the rank and file within a business and to a leader or to a HRBP or et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, yeah.
So taking people along on that journey, helping them understand their role in the change. And then you will need specific targeted change programs as well to address systemic issues.
Yeah.
And I think that speaks to a lot of the work that you do around representation in the top.
Yeah.
But you're not going to increase that without a specific intervention and measure.
Absolutely not.
Hoping that it will get better is not good enough.
No. Intentionality is right at its core.
Yeah, at its core. And you will need to put focus there and energy there to ensure that it gets the desired outcome. But I think you can only do that when you have the wraparound context of data
yeah.
in your business and the lack of representation at various levels, how people are feeling, the nuances and the challenges themselves, to then help you inform that program so it's specifically right for the business. You know, most people are under the perception, and to an extent maybe there are some D&I projects that are just kind of cookie cutter, you know, copy and paste in the business.
Revenue generators.
But I would like to think that to an extent there is a lot of nuance and data that goes into delivering a program in any business.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we'd actually see more cases of things going wrong than right if that was the case.
Really super interesting. What's the role of allyship in this whole? We hear a lot about the words talked about a lot.
Yeah.
Really interested in your opinion around that.
I think
that's a swig of water question, clearly.
Yeah, well, I know I was going to go into another tirade, so I was...
you're just getting ready for it.
Yeah, lubricate the vocal cords. I think the role of allyship is an important one.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there are misconceptions around allyship, because allyship, again, is almost thought about this like one way of showing up for a marginalized person in a business. And I think... first and foremost, allyship is understanding the challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there are people in businesses that are like, oh, I want to be an ally to people of color. I want to be an ally to the LGBTQ plus community. I want to be an ally to people with disabilities. But they don't fundamentally understand the challenge.
Yeah.
You can't be an ally if you don't.
The challenge of being an ally, or the challenge of being in one of those groups, or both?
Challenge of being in one of those groups.
Okay.
It's like mastering your brief. It's like, you know, how can you be an engineer if you don't understand code? How can you, a software engineer if you don't understand code? How can you be an structural engineer if you don't understand maths?
Yeah.
You have to master your brief. So to show up as an ally, fundamentally, you have to have a strong grip of the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And then also understanding the needs of the people that you want to be an ally to.
Because mm-hmm.
that's where allyship goes wrong. And I remember I made this mistake. I was like, when I started my journey, you know, and there's probably some saviorism syndrome in there.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I'm going to come in and save the world, and, you know, for people who are black and people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. And I remember Nadia saying to me, well, you know that there are also women in the workplace and people with disabilities in the workplace. And I was like, wait, I never thought about them. And I was like, oh, well, maybe I can't save the workplace or the world. I need to think more broadly and develop my understanding and deepen my knowledge. And I think a lot of people go into savior mode. They try and save people. They think they know what's best.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you only get to true allyship when you do the work to fundamentally understand the challenge in itself. And then you speak to people who are experiencing that challenge for them to tell you how they want you to show up.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, you're just doing your version of allyship, not what allyship is needed for that community.
Yeah. Yeah, I talk about being kindly curious. So that is about understanding. So, because to your point earlier, acceptance is super important, right? But you can't really accept unless you understand, right? And you can't understand unless you're kindly curious. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
otherwise, you're just way, way back and going, yeah, rah, rah, go the black people, right? You know, without understanding, you need to kindly question to understand. Then when you understand, you can accept, and then you can really be an ally.
Yeah.
But you've got to go through all those steps, and that's quite hard work.
100%. I like kindly curious, because obviously curious is one of the key traits in the inclusive leadership model.
Mm.
But being kindly curious is what leads you to cultural intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, even the both of us, we've met, we've had maybe 3 or 4 conversations, and then we're meeting for the first time in person today. I can't say I know you.
No.
So even though we are 2 black men, how can I be an ally to you in the numerous nuances of the challenges that you face? It's impossible. But I can only do that through asking questions. You know, some of it might be awkward now, but like over time it would be, you know, what are the biggest challenges that you face in your career at this particular moment in your life? Or what are the things that you need most help with? Or like, what are the things that impact the way that you show up on a day-to-day? Like that question alone can range from everything to do with, like, you know, family, life, where you want to live in the world. Now you've maybe achieved the level of success, or it could boil down to like the cut and thrust of the pace of society. Could point to friendships, loneliness, the, you know, how life changes for people that reach your age. I'm making you sound like you're ancient.
I am ancient compared to you. I am ancient. Look, I've got no problem with it. I'm settling into being uncle.
Well, look, you know, uncle's a term of respect and
affection. I love it.
Exactly. But all of those things can impact the way that you show up on a day-to-day. Now, unless you ask the question, you're never going to know.
Mm.
And it's those silent things that happen and people don't know. And, you know, we can have a conversation and you storm out. And I'm like, why did you storm out? That's rude. Well, maybe there was something happening that I just didn't know about. But as a consequence of not being kindly curious, I can't get to the bottom of.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Which is why we use it. I should just think I talk about superpowers a lot. It's a leadership superpower that's underrated. And the people who do it well are the most successful, because that allows them to connect with the people they lead. And that doesn't mean, that's everyone, by the way, right? In a way that allows them to support them, allows them to be actually, because the other superpower is empathy, right? Yeah. And empathy is about being in someone else's shoes, not looking down at them, being in their shoes. Now, how can you ever get into their shoes if you aren't understanding them? And the only way to understand is to be kindly curious. So why'd you do that? That's not kindly curious.
Yeah,
it's just annoying. But there's a way of talking to people so that they open up to you, and that allows you to be a better leader, mentor, coach to them. And I think if you have that, if you multiply that out in an organization, wow, how good would that organization be?
Yeah.
For everybody.
I agree.
You know, it'd be just superb. We covered a lot of ground. And fun enough, when we talk about when we're in this last section about talking about the problem, sometimes it feels a bit, oh, this is really hard. But actually with you, it's felt slightly more optimistic. So the question I ask everyone in closing is, why should we be hopeful?
I think we should be hopeful because change is possible. It's hard.
It's very hard. Yeah.
And it's possible because there are key things that you can do to really drive it, if that makes sense. Like if we didn't know what to do, then I think it would be quite daunting. And you'd probably notice that in my tone.
Yeah.
But I think there are clear things that you can do to really drive, change. One is understanding the challenge through data, through learning, through knowledge. There's so much of it. Google is there and, you know, you can implement your own data tools. And, you know, the world is changing.
Yeah.
So businesses need to change. People talk about, oh, is this wokeness gone mad, an overcorrection? Well, no. I mean, even the data would tell you it's not an overcorrection. Because for every person of color or woman who's promoted, there's been 8 other people who are white middle-aged men who haven't.
Yeah.
Not that there's anything wrong with white middle-aged men, but the data is clear.
Yeah.
It's not changing fast enough. But we are living in a world where if you look at like the key challenges that are facing Western society, Europe and the US, we have an aging working population, which means that we're going to be increasingly relying on skilled migration.
Yep.
Now, which means that our teams are going to be increasingly diverse, which means you need to have inclusive leadership, inclusive leadership in the makeup, but also lead inclusively in style.
Yeah. If you want to have the most talented people.
Yes, the most talented people. Now, when you've got the most talented people, to make sure that they're a high-performing team, and Google's done a lot of work on that around Project Aristotle, high-performing teams, at the heart of high-performing teams, is psychological safety.
Yeah.
At the heart of psychological safety is inclusion. So everything is connected. So, you know, I'm hopeful because at some point, as people implement technology and AI and their businesses become hyper-efficient, and then looking for those margins with the people that they've got left, they're going to be going, actually, it would be great if they felt included and there was representation, because then actually they'll do their job even better.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm hopeful. That people might be resisting it now, but, you know, Una King, who's the chief diversity officer at Uber, she said something recently that we have to have a cathedral mindset. And it's the small changes over time is what's going to build the cathedral. Cathedrals are made over 500 years.
That's right.
So, you know, and I think it's something that's quite unique to maybe, I think, millennials, Gen Zs, Gen Alphas, that we want everything now. Maybe it's because of the instantaneous nature of technology.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's probably done a lot of good in the way that we are activists and we show up in spaces. But I think from a change perspective, there's a little shift that needs to be done within the workplace, but it will get there because that's where it's going.
Yeah.
And I think any CEO, leader who's worth his salt knows that. Even if they have beliefs to the contrary, they know that to future-proof their businesses, they will have to go that way.
Although, so 100% agree, I'm taking your term, 100% agree with you, but the tenure of a CEO is normally shorter than the length of time required for the change.
Yes.
And so when you're a CEO, and I have been one, you're thinking in quarters. I know your job is to be a long-term thinking, but the reality is you're a short-term thinking. You're thinking quarters and years and 2 years and 3 year cycles, and probably not a lot more than that, because you might not have the job in 3 years. And I also say, so where does pushing for a greater and more diverse workforce fit into that? Now, you're right. That's why I sort of said, you know, if you want the best talent, then you have to be there. And organizations are... The best organizations have the best people, right?
Yeah,
and so I'm with you. I hope that we can enlighten people enough to say, you know, even if you're thinking in the short term, getting the best people gives you the best chance of success. And having a diverse mindset about inclusion and belonging gives you the best chance of getting the greatest people. And surely that's the answer, right?
Yeah. I also think CEOs are concerned about legacy. to an extent.
But
also, it's also why everything's got to be strategic. It can't be a case of initiativitis. You do lots of different things. It's got to be strategic.
Yeah. You know, what I'm hoping is a lot of them get a lot longer to build the cathedral, because a business is like a cathedral, right?
Yeah.
To build their cathedrals, right? And we don't often, me in the CEO's seat, get the length of time to build the cathedrals we want. And I hope that as time goes on, people get more time. I'm not sure that is definitely going to happen. But for sure, what you're doing, what you're talking about, and I think the viewpoints and perspectives of your generations and the ones following you make me hopeful that things will change too.
Yeah. And I think there's a point there. Well, I'm seeing a point emerge around the short term versus the long term. And I think if you're a CEO, and of course, you know, your main concern is around profitability and success of the organization, the short term, to your point, is getting the best people. But I think also the legacy is ensuring that the business is a business that that the best talent of the future are going to want to work for. And most CEOs don't even know the makeup and the needs and wants of their future workforce, even though the data's there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there is enormous power in showing them that, so they prioritize that now, even though they may not see the benefits of it in their tenure.
Yes.
Because their commitment to the business is in the here and now, but also the future.
Yeah.
No, that's part of their legacy.
So I think that's the legacy points of a good and valid point, but it all comes back to where you start, which is people.
Yeah. Most
and I, you know, rather than, so I talk a lot about, it's not DE&I for the sake of it. It's about running amazing organizations. But to do that, you need the best people. And if you're not open to a diverse workforce and leadership workforce, then you're not going to have the best team, right? So, hey, how about think about that?
Yeah.
And that pushes up the agenda weirdly more than just saying, here's an initiative in this space. Because trust me, there are so many initiatives a CEO can pick. So we help them pick the right one by saying it's about short term and building a brilliant legacy. I think that's a great way, a great way of finishing. Look, it's been great. Time's flown, right? Time flies when you're having fun. Tolu, it's been amazing talking to you. You've done some incredible things. I'm not joking when I say you're inspirational. I used to think inspirational people needed to be people that I looked up to and elders, and actually now I can look around me at people like you who are committed to doing what you want to do, committed to the work, committed to making change, and find that equally as inspirational. So well done you.
Thank you.
I wish you all the success in everything you do. I know, look, we've dissected it. I know you're going to make it. So take us all with you when you change the world.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And equally, you're an inspiration as well. I don't say that just because you pay me the compliment, but I always think about the shoulders that I stand on, the ground that's been broken, the portrayals that have been smashed, the stereotypes that black men can't be CEOs or black people can't be CEOs, and you've been a CEO, and now you're turning your journey into a conversation, into a program to help increase representation. And my thing is, I feel like people don't do enough, and you're doing what you can, and that is hugely inspirational.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we'll try and do our bit.
Yeah.
Yay, us. Brilliant. Well, you can come back and tell us more in a few years' time.
Yeah, for sure. I'll be back.
All right. Good, man. Thanks very much.
Thank you.